listening to His Time on Worldwide KFUO. We are the messenger of good news. That is, we're here to tell you about who Jesus is and what He's done for you. My name is Pastor Jonathan Fisk, and we are about ready to head toward our daily New Testament study, looking at the Daily Lectionary today. A guest, Dr. Jeffrey Kloa, professor of exegetics at St. Louis Seminary, Concordia Seminary in St. Louis here, talking about John chapter 7, verses 1 through 13. If you have a question or comment about the text, we always love to hear you call in 1-800-730-2727, or you can tweet me at Rev Fisk, and I will try to take your question or comment on the air as well. You get them to me sooner, it's more likely to happen, because sometimes we run out of time. We're two pastors, we like to talk. For right now, let's go ahead and look at that text itself. John chapter 7, verses 1 to 13. After this, Jesus went about in Galilee. He would not go in about in Judea because the Jews were seeking to kill him. Now, the Jews' feast of booths was at hand. So his brothers said to him, "Leave here and go to Judea, that your disciples also may see the works you are doing. For no one works in secret if he seeks to be known openly. If you do these things, show yourself to the world." For not even his brothers believed in him. Jesus said to them, "My time has not yet come, but your time is always here. The world cannot hate you, but it hates me, because I testify about it that its works are evil. You go up to the feast. I am not going up to this feast, for my time has not yet fully come." After saying this, he remained in Galilee. But after his brothers had gone up to the feast, then he also went up, not publicly, but in private. The Jews were looking for him at the feast and saying, "Where is he?" And there was much muttering about him among the people. While some said, "He is a good man," others said, "No, he is leading the people astray." Yet for fear of the Jews, no one spoke openly of him. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. A bit of a shorter text and really a transition text. It's kind of, again, too bad that we didn't get to get into John chapter 6 in its depth, at least with part of yesterday and then maybe coming into today. Hopefully, Dr. Kloa will be able to, I'm sure he will be able to bring us some specifics and some depth right here just with what we have. But really, what's setting up now is everything that's going to happen from chapter 7, chapter 8, and into chapter 9. There's this entire event at the Feast of Booths and what that means. We'll be digging into that as well on the other side of the break with Dr. Kloa. Now, with just about 2 minutes here before we're going to go to that break, have our daily catechism reading, kind of some closing parting thoughts about the event last night. I was very happy that it turned out to be peaceful. There's so much chaos out there in America right now. You hear about Berkeley and the various violent protests that go on there. It is so much better for all sides if we believe in civil discourse, if we believe in letting all ideas be heard, even the ones we think actually, even if they actually are hateful, right? The worst ideas in the history of the world, well, if they're heard, the country we live in is founded on the belief that most people will think that they're nonsense and that those murderous, hateful ideas, they only come to power when they're consolidated in the power of one person, but that when all the ideas are allowed to be there, when the freedom of speech is allowed to flow, good ideas will trump and counter bad ideas. So I was very thankful that that is kind of what happened last night. And again, as I spoke to some of the students afterwards who disagreed with my position, asked some good questions. Some of them were kind of talking point questions that maybe they hadn't thought about, but some of them were good questions. They certainly were all earnest questions. It was nice to see that they were willing to come up and not sling mud, but have a discussion. And that's what Christians, we have to strive for this. We have to strive to open that door to the other side, whether they were talking about a political theory or whether we're talking about just trying to talk to your neighbor about who Jesus is and what he's done, right? Now, we can't hide in bunkers and hold tight and fast to the sand slipping between our fingers of this present age. Rather, we got to seek a way to find love for others and express it, share it, give it, speak it. Yeah. You're listening to His Time on Worldwide KFUO. I'm your host, Pastor Jonathan Fisk. Catechism right now, news and weather, then back with John chapter 7. Stick around. Welcome back to His Time on Worldwide KFUO, the messenger of good news. I'm your host, Pastor Jonathan Fisk, and it's time for our daily New Testament study, looking at the daily lectionary from your Lutheran service book and also your Pray Now app and Treasury of Daily Prayer from Concordia Publishing House. We're looking today at John chapter 7, verses 1 through, and I just lost it even though I said it a few moments ago. Bad radio here. Gee McGee. John 7, verses 1 through 13. Our guest, though, I do know off the top of my head, his name is Dr. Jeffrey Kloa. He's a professor at Concordia Seminary in St. Louis, a master of the critical apparatus. We'll maybe talk about that in just a moment. But if you do have questions about John chapter 7, verses 1 to 13, please do give us a call, 1-800-730-2727, or you can tweet me at Rev Fisk, and we'll take your question or comment on the air as we move through the text, trying to rightly distinguish law and gospel for you. Dr. Kloa, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So tell the listener a little bit about your particular role, what you teach at the seminary, and then maybe, like I just mentioned a moment ago, your specialty. You really are kind of a top guy on helping us understand what textual criticism is all about.
Sure. Thank you. I teach New Testament, professor of New Testament exegetical theology here at Concordia Seminary. I've been here for about 18 years. The last several years, I've had an additional role of provost of the seminary, which is overseeing the students and academics and faculty of the seminary, but on a day-to-day basis is pretty much emails and meetings. So it's not...
That's why you went into the parish ministry in the first place,
exactly,
right?
Exactly, yeah. So I could reply to emails 16 hours a day, yeah.
So then Mr. Bates here just told me you also teach a Bible study at St. Paul's Lutheran Church in De Pere?
I do, yes. For the last couple of years, I teach a Sunday morning Bible study for the congregation, but is also broadcast on KFUO at 9:30 every morning, and I think rebroadcast on Thursdays at 1. And it's a, fairly detailed verse-by-verse reading from the Greek. Right now we're studying Philippians. We're in chapter 4. And so almost finished with the book, and soon, probably after Easter, we'll move on to the book of Acts.
And then again, a little bit, I don't want to go into the weeds on this, but textual criticism is a valuable topic and one that I think many people don't have much experience with. So maybe, can you just overview that in a minute?
Sure. What textual criticism or textual scholarship, whatever term you want to use, studies is the manuscripts that were copied from the beginning of the New Testament, from the apostles, down to the present day, and roughly 6,000 Greek manuscripts, 10,000 Latin manuscripts, analyzing their history, how they relate to one another, how they were copied, and then where there are differences in wording, in very specific wording between the manuscripts, how do we go about determining which of the readings are original? So it's a lot of historical study, study of the Greek in great detail, and trying to be as confident, fully confident in the wording of our New Testament.
Well, and contrary to what, a person might think as they initially hear this, there's different copies and there's some differences in them. Contrary to that being something that proves to us there's errors in the Bible, from a historical perspective, this strengthens our case for the Bible's authenticity as a document from the time it claims to be from.
Yeah, absolutely. The manuscript tradition actually is very ancient, going back even to the second century, roughly about 20 manuscripts of the New Testament, small fragmentary pieces to be sure. But it allows us to trace through a copying tradition and a history of the text that actually shows remarkable reliability, copy to copy, scribe to scribe. It becomes very easy with enough study to determine what copyists were doing, why they did what they did, to resolve those differences. And also comparing how early pastors and theologians were quoting the biblical text and seeing the really remarkable consistency in wording, especially when compared to other texts from the ancient world. The amount of material and the copying traditions, that is the very conservative copying traditions relating to the New Testament, actually show the remarkable veracity and consistency of the wording of the text.
Yeah, compared to something like, say, Plato or Homer, it's not even really in the same ballpark. You got professional game versus kind of a high school court almost.
For Plato, he's a very popular author in the ancient world. But Plato, we know, actually had some pretty significant editorial revisions in a couple of times in its manuscript history. So rather than just sort of make a copy of a copy, scholars would sort of annotate their copy of Plato and then produce essentially a new edition, sort of an updated edition. And that caused a lot of havoc, you might say, in the manuscript tradition of Plato. Whereas the New Testament didn't have that happen. There was no one who said, hey, let's completely rewrite the New Testament and come up with a, you know, sort of an annotated edition. So it's just the manner of handling the text is different for the New Testament.
We could easily spend, you know, an hour or more on this, but just thank you for that, because that's really helpful that to know that this is out there and that as Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, we care about being on top of these kinds of things. We don't want to hide from the history because we believe the history actually strengthens our case.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So we're going to jump into John chapter 7. What should we know kind of moving into verses 1 to 13 here? What would you give us as a context or a setup?
Yeah, well, over the weekend, the readings covered John 6, which is, you know, quite a significant chapter in the Gospel of John, both for Jesus making clear his identity, that he is from the Father, that he provides for his people, just as Moses provided. And so he is a fulfillment of Moses providing bread in the wilderness. But at the end of that chapter, Jesus becomes rejected. If you look at verse 66, many of his disciples, and that's a key word in John, many of his disciples turned back and no longer followed him. So the ministry of Jesus isn't appearing to be as successful as one might think, given his claims and the things he has been doing, the signs that he has been doing in the Gospel of John. In chapter 7, then, we get a shift to Jesus heading to Judea and for the festival of the booths, as we'll see. And this whole question of, again, Jesus' identity, who is following him, how do you follow him, what is the proper response to him, and how does he make himself known, especially, are the key themes. So 7, 1 to 13 is in some ways a transitional section. Not a lot of, you might say, deep theology like you'll find in chapter 6 with the bread of life, or later in chapter 7 with, you know, I'm the living waters, or I'm the light of the world. But it does highlight the proper response to Jesus and his identity and his mission.
So one more question before we jump into that, because you mentioned that word disciples being a loaded term in John, and I remember that from being taught that at seminary. And then just this last week, I was trying to rediscover why that was, and I've been unable to find that. So can you kind of, what do you mean when you say you got to pay careful attention to the word disciples in John, that it's a technical term of sorts?
Well, there's several groups that Jesus interacts with, or that John describes Jesus as interacting with. So you have the 12. In fact, if you look at verse 67, you've got the 12 specifically mentioned. Then you have disciples, which is this kind of broader group of those who are following Jesus in some way, although they tend to be, you know, rather fickle in their following. Mm. They come and go depending on what Jesus says or doesn't say or does or doesn't do. And in fact, in chapter 7, they're a little bit on the fence, you know. And then you have crowds, which, you know, pop in, pop out, and then you have the Jews, the Judeans, depending on how you translate that, which are kind of the opposition group to Jesus throughout the gospel. So you might say there's, you know, kind of a circles, emanating circles from Jesus, you know, out from the 12 to the disciples, to the crowds, to the Jews. And as you get further out from the circle, you find more opposition to Jesus.
Yeah, so it's that distinction between disciples and crowds that maybe is the thinnest line, I guess. You know, is that right?
Yeah, you might say some from the crowds become disciples, and some from the disciples end up going back to the crowds.
Yeah, okay. That's helpful. Thank you. Okay, so picking up at verse 1 here, just about 5 minutes before we go into our break. After this, Jesus went about in Galilee. He would not go about in Judea because the Jews were seeking to kill him. Now, there's not a ton of, like you said, deep theology there, but I always, at least in my own preaching and teaching, whenever we start a pericope and it says something like, after this, I make sure I say, now, to understand what's going on, you got to find out what the after this means. You can't just kind of jump in and not know what happened before. And we did that a little bit, but that also then leads into now this growing movement in the book from the Jews asking questions, again, them being now not just Jewish by blood, but this is the party of the Pharisees, moving from asking questions to this really, plot to murder him.
Absolutely, yeah. And the, so the after these things, the metatauta in John is kind of a transitional phrase, but it does, as you say, connect to, especially to the response in verse 66, where, again, and the word is disciples walk away from Jesus because of his claim to be the bread of life. So we have to read this section as following on that negative reaction of the, quote, disciples to his teaching. And you're absolutely right. This plot, seeking to kill him, I would say that's a plot.
Yeah.
And it really does cast a bit of a pall over the rest of the book, because now whenever Jesus interacts with these groups, we have to understand that they're trying to kill him. Okay.
Right.
They're not interacting with him on a sort of honest level or a genuine interest. They're interacting with him for the purpose of putting him to death.
And I love John is such a craftsman. The way that he does this is so gentle, if I can say that, as a storyteller, that is the image that comes to mind is I'm sitting on my patio in an afternoon and I see the evening shadow kind of far off away from me. But if I'm not paying attention, suddenly it's closer and it's still not at me, but it's bigger than it was. Mm-hmm. And then next thing I know, I'm sitting in the dark. And that's kind of what's happening with this plot is first John's just kind of dropping it. Oh yeah. And by the way, and then it grows and grows and grows all the way to the cross.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah, it's sort of almost a toss-off line. It's just four words, five words in Greek.
Right.
But it really sets the tone for the rest of the book.
Verse 2 tells us, then now the Feast of Booths, the Jews' Feast of Booths, was at hand. Again, a throwaway line, but in my mind, this sucker is really a key to understanding much of what's going to happen in the next two chapters in terms of why Jesus uses some of the metaphors that he uses. Can you talk a little bit about the Feast of Booths and its history and how this might inform the text?
Right. So to understand the Feast of Booths or Tabernacles, it's kind of translated either way. You have to go back to the book of Leviticus, chapter 23. And in that chapter, we have laid out really all the festivals, beginning with Sabbath, and it goes through Passover and harvest festivals. All the festivals are listed there. And the last one listed is this Festival of Booths. And again, the text is very clear on how Israel is to observe these festivals as a remembrance of God, Yahweh, taking them out of Egypt and bringing them into the land. So the Festival of Booths gets its name from this command. If you look at verse 42 there, you shall dwell in booths for 7 days. All native Israelites shall dwell in booths, that your generations may know that I made the people of Israel dwell in booths when I brought them out of the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. So just like the Passover was a remembrance of the deliverance from Egypt, the Festival of Booths was a remembrance of the time in the wilderness when they had to live in tents, and when God provided for their daily bread through the manna and the water, from the rock. Here, now in this harvest festival, and again, this is it's a fall harvest festival. It's not the grain festival in the spring. It's the festival of the harvest of grapes and fruit. Remember that the Lord your God has always provided for you and continues to provide for you. And it's not explicit, but I think this is the implication. Why booths? Why these tents that they would live in? Actually, I'll explain what they are. It's a reminder, again, of the transitory nature of life and that we are solely under the guidance and protection and care and provision of God, so that the Israelites would remember that God is the one who has brought them into the land and will continue to provide for them. So it sounds kind of strange to us, but for a week, people would build these little mud huts, you might say, out of sticks and grass. They would put them on the roof of their house if they lived in an urban setting. They'd put them in their courtyard if they're in a more rural setting. But they would kind of, you know, go native. They would camp out for a week and observe this this festival of the tabernacles as a remembrance of Yahweh's provision. And then after this week-long living in the tents, they would have a big festival on the eighth day and celebrate all that God had done. So it was a pretty big festival. Josephus, who's a Jewish historian from just after the time of Jesus, reports that this was, in some ways, the most popular festival of that time, perhaps even more popular than the Passover, that more people participated. Again, you could do it from home. You can build your little tent and, you know, have a little camp out for a week as a reminder of God's care and protection.
It was a first century camp out Oktoberfest.
That's kind of what it is.
It was a neat time. Well, we'll talk a little bit more about that on the other side of this break. Listen to His Time on Worldwide KFUO, the messenger of good news. My guest, Pastor Dr. Jeffrey Kloa of Concordia Seminary in St. Louis. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Faith and Family is going on a road trip. We're packing up the studio and heading out to Breeze Park Senior Living Community in St. Charles, Missouri for a special segment centered around your heart. February is National Heart Association Month, and Breeze Park is going to help us celebrate with a heart-healthy recipe, some good exercises you can do anywhere, and other fun surprises. There'll be a whole lot of love that day. That's February 26th, 10 a.m. on Faith and Family. For more information on Breeze Park and other Lutheran Senior Services Senior Living Communities, go to lssliving.org.
I'm World Lutheran News Digest host Kip Allen. Every day, things happen that affect the lives of Lutherans worldwide. Whether it's mercy efforts to a disaster-stricken community, threats to religious liberty, or cultural trends, World Lutheran News Digest takes an in-depth look at one issue each week as I interview newsmakers and experts, while Sarah Golseth presents a quick look at the week's news. World Lutheran News Digest may be heard every Wednesday at 2:30 and Saturday at 9:30 on Worldwide KFUO.
His Time on Worldwide KFUO, the messenger of good news, talking with Dr. Jeffrey Kloa of Concordia Seminary in St. Louis about John chapter 7. If you got a question or comment about the text, call us 1-800-730-2727 or tweet me on Twitter, and we'll try to get to your question here on the air. Also, if you're kind of fascinated by this talk about the Feast of Booths and Jewish festivities, today on His Time at 10 a.m. with Mr. Andy Bates, there will be a discussion about Jewish holy days with Pastor Kevin Parviz and how to serve your neighbor, if they happen to be of the Jewish persuasion, during that time. For example, you know, maybe what not to give them because they can't even eat it during that time, things like that. Also, we were talking there as we went away, Dr. Kloa, about the Feast of Booths being sort of an Oktoberfest of sorts. They wouldn't have had the beer, of course, but a great party, a gathering together for 7 days. I mean, this was like the festival of festivals. This puts, you know, Easter in some ways to shame in the way that we celebrate. It was so big. And one of the other pieces of the story, at least in my mind, is how the tradition, the intertestamental tradition, affected this, where they would set up these massive illuminations. The priests would build this big fire in the temple courts, and it would go out and they would light all the other fires of the city so that everyone's getting their light, kind of like the Olympic torch moves, right? Then they would light up the night for the celebrations. And every day also, they would bring water from the pool of Siloa up to the altar to clean the water or to clean the altar. And that when Jesus stands up on the great day of the feast, we're not going to get there in the text, but for a few days, and he says, you know, I am the light of the world, there's a ton of light going on around him. And when he says, I have living water, he's literally calling out that the entire festival is really missing the point, which is him.
Oh, absolutely. And yeah, you'll have to spend some time on this when you get to those points in the text. But you know, this kind of interesting, if you will, indecision of Jesus in this part of the text,
right,
is actually there for a reason, as we'll see, as he rejects the efforts of his brothers to get him to go. But that he's going to go on his time, and we'll have to talk about that.
Yeah.
But he does, when he goes, he uses this as an opportunity again to make himself the point of the festivals. So, you know, as he himself is our Sabbath rest, right? He also is himself the tabernacle,
right?
He is himself you know, as you say, the living waters. He is the light of the world. So he you know, uses, you might say, you know, contemporary illustrations, or here's what's going on in the news. Let me tell you how this makes clear who I am.
So let's talk about his brothers, like you said a moment ago. Verse 3, his brothers said to him, leave here and go to Judea, that your disciples may also see the works you are doing. For no one works in secret if he seeks to be known openly. If you do these things, show yourself to the world. For not even his brothers believed in him. Jesus said to them, my time is not yet come, but your time is always here. And then he's going to go on and talk about the world not hating you. But I just kind of stop right there. The brothers, interestingly, they kind of believe maybe he's doing miracles, but they kind of don't. They're really challenging and pushing him quite a bit. And show yourself to the world. It's almost like they want to pile on. Like, look, if you're going to be the king, can you get it going so we can join in here?
Yeah.
And let me ask this question from Twitter, sure, too, though. So Chris asked, though, he really zeroes in on this idea of the time, right? And he asks, mm-hmm, he says, Jesus repeats John 2, 4b to his brothers, a reference to the cross, that his time is not yet. But what is he getting at with this your time is always here stuff as well? So anything you want to say out of that?
Yeah. And this is kind of a tricky one because, just to be straightforward, the Greek word in John 7, kairos, is actually a different word from what occurs elsewhere in John, hora, which is hour. So you see this in John 2, and you see this throughout the rest of the Gospel of John, that when, John 5, and you can go through a whole list of places where the word hour occurs. Yeah, the word hour consistently in the Gospel of John refers to the hour when he is victorious on the cross, in ushering in the new age after his resurrection, in the resurrection of people from the dead. In other words, this whole eschatological end times brought into the present work of Jesus on the cross. So hour, look for that word specifically, is a very critical word in John. Now, kairos is actually used, the word here in John 7, verse 6, and again in verse 8, is a different word. And it does not in John refer to this victory motif that you see in John through the cross. Rather, kairos should be understood as kind of a time appointed by God, but in this sense, that every person has a kairos, an opportune time or a set time under the direction of the Father. So it is Jesus saying, look, it is not yet my time. That is, my Father does not yet want me to go there. But you guys, and this is a bit of a really slam on his brothers. You know, and he says in verse 8 here? Yeah, because you guys always have the time. In other words, you guys actually aren't following the will of the Father because you are not following his kairos. You're doing things willy-nilly. You can pick and choose when you're going to go. You can make a decision based on whether you feel like it or not, whether you're going to have a good time or not. You guys, because you are of the world, and this is an important word in this text, you are not manifesting the kind of life lived under the guidance and care of the Father. So it is a contrast here between Jesus' kairos and his following the will of God and his brothers who are not following the will of God and are, you know, random in their decision-making, random in their way of relating to the world. So it is, it's a bit of a rebuke of his brothers, but it is not the same as the word hour, where Jesus does make clear his ultimate goal of cross and resurrection.
Right. So it's not actually a quote of John 2, 4b.
Correct. It's a different Greek word.
Right. And that's why we train our pastors in Greek, right?
one reason. Yeah.
Yeah. So, moving on then, and if you want to go back again and talk about their misguided desire, that in this kairos of theirs, and I heard you, I almost want to say it's like a destiny, right?
Yeah,
Jesus has
a
destiny
word, yeah,
he's really, mm-hmm, following. We,
yep,
just kind of make our own as we go. And so they're just trying to grab on to glory whenever they can.
Yep.
And he's doing instead the path set for him. And as a result, verse 7, the world cannot hate you. but it hates me because I testify about it that its works are evil.
Right.
You go up to the feast. I'm not going up to this feast for my, I'm assuming this is going to be Kairos. My destiny has not fully come.
Yep.
After saying this, he remained in Galilee.
Yep.
One kind of side thought here, you know, last night I spoke about marriage and I was trying at a college campus and there was some protesting and I was trying very hard to find a middle ground so we could have a conversation. But then this verse this morning really kind of condemned me. It's like, why didn't I just testify that the works were evil? That's what Jesus did, right? It's a really intense thing.
Yeah, it's called preaching the law, right?
Right.
And you know, here's one of the challenges of Jesus' ministry consistently in the Gospels is he has no difficulty telling people that they have rejected him and they are therefore under judgment. And he sort of, you know, shakes the dust off his sandals and walks away. I mean, it's a pretty strong law statement here. And when he talks about the world, I mean, this is a key word here, cosmos in verse 7, that you guys are world and I am not of the world. And to get that, you really have to go back to chapter 1 of John's gospel, where a familiar passage, he was in the world was made through him, yet the world did not know him. Key phrase, the world did not know him. He came to his own did not receive him, but to all who did receive him, who believed in his name, he gave the right to become the children of God, who were born not of blood, nor of the will of the flesh, see that theme again of doing things on your own time, but of God. So when Jesus talks about the cosmos, you're in kind of a bad spot. You are part of that, you know, larger group, the crowd, who cannot, in some sense, will not listen to his message nor understand the significance of his death and his resurrection. So he puts his brothers in their place here, that you are not in the right category, and in fact, you almost have no chance.
And you definitely kind of got to think about James, the early church father, who was his brother by blood, at least so far as tradition goes.
Right.
It would have been among this group and an unbeliever, an antagonist even, who then believes in Christ after the resurrection. This had to be on his mind most of his life, I imagine, this kind of rebuke from his brother.
Well, you have, and this is consistent again throughout all the Gospels, where Jesus' family does not... Well, either they don't understand or they flat out reject Jesus. That's consistent before his resurrection. But when you get to the book of Acts in chapter 1, well, then his brothers start to come around. And in fact, James is mentioned in 1 Corinthians 15, I think it's verse 7, as one of the people to whom Jesus appeared after his resurrection. So, when the resurrected Jesus appears to you, that might change your thinking a little bit.
It tends to do that, as far as I can see. Yeah. So after this, verse 9, he remained in Galilee, but after his brothers had gone up to the feast, then he also went up, not publicly, but in private. And I think this is just a kind of a classic stumbling point. Like, well, did he lie?
Right. Well, I don't know if you want to talk about this, but there is... you know, the manuscripts had a hard time with this in verse 8, you know, that I will not go up or I will not yet go up, you know.
Oh, yeah, sure.
To kind of make it a little bit easier, and it's kind of an interesting, kind of manuscript question. Although at the end of the day, I mean, the way you have to read this is, again, the request of the brothers is pretty specific.
Yep.
We want you to go up so that you can do cool stuff to make people like you and think that you're really important.
Right.
And Jesus says, no, that's not what I'm about. I don't do things on your schedule. I do things on God's schedule. And I'm not going to follow your plan. So when he says, you know, I'm not going to go up to this feast, is he lying or is he simply rebuking them and saying, look, you're not the path that I'm following, so just go away. I think that's clearly what Jesus is doing. He's rejecting the manner of going up and the purpose of going up that his brothers desire. And then he goes on his own terms for his own purposes in accord with the will of the Father.
I think verse 10, I mean, if John had found a problem with this, I think he would have said something. But instead, he just says, now he didn't go up publicly, he went up privately, because that's what he intended to do all along. He's not going up to show off.
Well, and again, yeah, not publicly. You know, so that's the key word, because his brothers wanted him to go publicly with the show. You know, send out the elephants and the clowns and let's put on the big extravaganza. And Jesus says, no, I'm going to go, but not in the way that you suggest.
Well, and he does eventually go up publicly. We know how that turns out, right?
Right. I mean, well, but again, his public statement is not to do the works. It's to identify in his words who he is.
So the Jews were looking for him at the feast, saying, where is he? And there was much muttering about him among the people. While some said he is a good man, others said, no, he is leading the people astray. Yet for fear of the Jews, no one spoke openly of him. And here, I mean, this is this train, this shadow creeping across the floor. Like, it's not going good. It was. There were crowds following him. Everyone said it was great. And now, not so much. It's starting to be a problem.
Well, and again, you got to be careful with the vocabulary, or recognize the precision with which the evangelist is using the vocabulary, right? So verse 12, they kept on saying, it's an imperfect verb in Greek, they kept on saying that, hey, he's a good man, you know? Well, I mean, I'd be happy to be called a good man.
Sure.
But if you call Jesus a good man, you have not identified him properly.
Right.
So it's this, he's a good guy, you know, he's fine. It's an insufficient confession. So it's still in this, as you say, creeping shadow section of John, where people are trying to figure Jesus out, and he continues to make clear his mission from the Father, his work on the cross, and the irony, again, throughout John, is that the more he makes himself known, the more people run away or want to kill him.
I find it interesting that the statement about him being a good man rings true with the way that kind of modern pagan or various other religions, say Buddhists, philosophers, they want to categorize Jesus as some sort of good prophet, that he meant well, that we can learn from him. We love his golden rule and all that. So it's actually the same way that when the world doesn't want to hate Jesus today, they try to kind of put him in this category. And yet, coming right out of this section in which the guy is saying, eat my flesh and drink my blood, and everyone's saying, this is crazy talk.
Right.
And you got Peter with the real confession. You know, where else are we going to go? You're God.
Mm-hmm. Right. And the term agathos, good, you know, it doesn't quite have the implications or the nuances that we would have today, you know, where just sort of he's a good guy. There is some, ideal good person, you know, has a good moral conduct, can be emulated and modeled. I guess there's some overlap. You know, certainly there's overlap, but it is a bit more technical in first century Greek. The flip side, of course, is what the others are saying.
Right.
He's a deceiver. He's leading people astray. And so again, you know, a good person is someone you emulate, whereas someone who leads people astray is someone you flee from. So some people are kind of looking toward Jesus in a certain way, not a sufficient way, but others are looking at the same Jesus and saying, no, he's a deceiver and he needs to be done away with. And in fact, this is what he ends up getting in trouble for later on with the Sanhedrin, being a deceiver. So you are correct. This is a you could pick this up and put it down in our present day setting without too much translation.
You have then in verse 13, I think it's pretty loaded as well in terms of John telling us how the Pharisees really affected the people in general. What kind of rule this religion was? It was not a rule of love. People were in fear.
Right. And again, it's a pretty interesting political time. You've got the Jewish leadership that is pretty much in control religiously and in some ways economically and politically in Jerusalem and Judea, not in Galilee, but in Jerusalem, Judea, because of their cozy relationship with the Romans. And so you always have this it's never purely religious thing going on here. and the Jews, and here really meaning sort of the leadership of the Jews centered in Judea and Jerusalem. They're not only, sort of the religious leaders, they also have some real political power, well, as we see in the Passion narratives. So this fear of the Jews is, kind of a legitimate fear, because there could be some governmental weight behind that. And so Jesus is, kind of this polarizing, that even though people have their opinions, they keep them to themselves.
My guest, Dr. Jeffrey Kloa of Concordia Seminary in St. Louis. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Jonathan. Take care.
Yeah, absolutely. You're listening to His Time on Worldwide KFUO, the messenger of good news. We'll be back in just a moment.